Okay, good morning. Good morning. Wow, thanks for saying hi to each other and hanging out. If you didn't know this, if you're new and didn't know this, we did just something so just crazy. We redid how we put chairs out here. And got wild in here. And so we're just, you know, just some real significant fears that have arisen in me in the last, you know, 8 days since doing this was nine, 10 days was would people even be able to find a seat? I mean, that was one. Would they face the front? I mean, that was another. Would they be able to talk to one another? And we just collectively killed it at all three of those. So way to go. Good for us. That did not throw us off. That was great. So my name's Tim, and it's really good to be with you. I'm the lead pastor here, in case I didn't say that yet. And I've got this great, great joke for you that I've been working on that I just want to start with. You know, I'll say it, and then you'll just think I'm so, you know, wonderful and funny and likable, and, you know, it'll be great. And then Phil stole it. So, and then Connor, you know, tried to revive it and pump life into it, and it didn't. I don't know if that worked either. So Connor and Phil will meet together maybe this afternoon, all afternoon, and we'll kind of work through that and deal with our stuff and see if we can rebuild our friendship. And Connor also stole something that I was really excited to celebrate with you, but I'm just going to go ahead and repeat it. Last week was just fantastic. It was so good to be together and to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And again, we say this over and over. It's something for those of us that are followers of Jesus that is part of every day for us in some way or another. But to do it collectively together on a day like that just was so great. And specifically, I just wanted to thank us for so many of you helped serve in some way. You lend a hand. You played some role or another in helping either Good Friday or Easter Sunday happen. And even, which is great, but even more important than that, I think, is so many of you prayed for and invited friends and family members, neighbors, coworkers, classmates, that kind of thing. And this is great. So I just wanted to thank you for that and just again celebrate. Nine people getting baptized across our three gatherings is what we pray for and hope for. And that was so, so wonderful to celebrate together. The other thing I do want to just call attention to is that there's a way that we have grown as a church pretty significantly in the last couple months, and you may be aware of it, you may not be, but there's a kind of an area of us as a community, as a church family, as a people that was a little bit of a, I would say, like a deficiency or a growth area, a weakness, and it's really changed, and we've grown significantly in this area in the last just probably 2 or 3 months, and that is in our ability to celebrate by clapping together. See, as evidence right by that, like, right, see, you proved, thank you, by the way. So we kind of teased ourselves for quite a few years that, hey, we just don't clap really well. So big, you know, we'd celebrate big things. We'd be like, hey, yay, Jesus. And that's just changed in the last few weeks. And so we've clapped for offering, we've clapped for in the middle of singing, we've clapped for all sorts of good news. And so just yay us. That's good. And you're like, why does that matter? And you're probably thinking, well, it matters because it's really fun to be on stage and have a bunch of people clap. That's not why it matters. It matters because we live in a city where frowning and looking stoic and even smoldering and reflective and we like to read a lot and think a lot and debate a lot, and none of that lends itself towards celebration. And when we get together because we know Jesus, there's reason to celebrate, and so we need to be good at celebrating, and that's part of it. We've become good at celebrating, and so that's why it matters. So there you go. Write that down. Remember it. Think about it often this week, and come back and clap next week. Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to pray, and then we're going to start a new series. Connor just mentioned it. It's been in front of us and mentioned it last week as well, but called Where Jesus Goes, and we're dealing with questions, doubts, and uncertainties. And so I want to take a little bit of time this morning kind of getting us kicked off in that, and so we're going to pray and then start into that. So let's pray together. God, you're good, and there are so many things that we have to celebrate, really, as we've just been talking about, to celebrate you and what you've done and what you are doing in our midst. And so, God, you in this place and in our lives and in this world, you are good, and you are loving, and you are true. And in our time right here, right now, would you help us to know that and to be able to celebrate that and to have that shape who we are and how we live. And Holy Spirit, we ask that you would be working in our time right here, that you would be present and moving in this room. And there's so many things that we can ask you for. And even as we've just sung, that you would be here and change us as a result of us meeting with you and knowing you. And it occurs to me this morning, just right now, that there's a lot of things that you want to do that we're not even aware of, that I can't even list out or pray for or identify, that there's things that you want to change in us and through us and work. And so would you do that here this morning? Would you be active in all the ways that we might not be able to identify? And Jesus, as we look to your word, as we look to you and to your story, would you guide us? Would you direct us? Would you teach us? Would you help us? Would you move us forward in whatever it is that we're stuck on this morning? It's in your name that we pray. Amen. If you've got a Bible, find your way to Luke chapter 24. Luke 24. It's actually, we're going to pick up where, if you were with us last week on Easter, we looked at this text. It's Matthew 24 records the resurrection of Jesus. Matthew, Mark, Luke. It's the third book in the New Testament. Feel free to grab one on the sides or on a screen somewhere. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and then chapter 24. The resurrection of Jesus is recorded. And then what we looked at together last week here was that these women, Mary, another Mary, and John, and a few other women go to the tomb. They see Jesus is not there, and then these two angels show up and they ask him this life-altering question of, why are you looking for the living among the dead? And they realize, we're looking for a dead Jesus, and dead Jesus doesn't exist. And so, what am I really looking for? And we asked ourselves that question. Well, the women go back and tell the disciples, and they don't really buy him. But Peter responds and goes looking for Jesus at the tomb. And that's the verse I want to look at as we start together this morning. It's Luke chapter 24, verse 12, and it says this. Peter, however, got up and ran to the tomb. Bending over, he saw the strips of linen lying by themselves, and he went away, wondering to himself what had happened. And again, we kind of pointed out that word wondering there is it's this idea of being amazed or astonished or admiring or being drawn to something. And what I picture Peter doing is walking away kind of like almost in a daze, like, what just happened? I'm not quite sure what's going on here. The women said that he wasn't in there, but I didn't quite believe him. I got to see for myself. He runs over there. He looks. Jesus isn't here, and it's clear something unexplainable has happened, something that he doesn't have all the answers for. It's not neatly packaged. He doesn't have a clear answer. He kind of walks away smiling, excited, hopeful, his heart racing, but he doesn't have all the answers. He doesn't know exactly what's going on. That's what this word wondering means, and this idea of being amazed and astonished. And I almost picture Peter kind of like looking off into the sky and going, what is really happening here? What does this mean? And he knows it means something good, but he's not quite sure. And maybe he trips because he's kind of looking off into the sky and he's amazed. And for many of us, we're at that place regularly, or we can remember being at that place when we met Jesus, that the sense of like, God is real and alive, and Jesus is alive, and he's at work, and he's doing something in me, but I'm not quite sure of all the other things. What happens next, right after that, is Jesus shows up and meets two guys as they're walking from Jerusalem to Emmaus, and there's a great story there. We're going to skip over that. And when the two guys get back to Jerusalem, they go and they tell the disciples, and they said, we met Jesus, he's alive. And they're talking about that, and that's where I want to pick it up. It's verse 36. While they were still talking about this, Jesus himself stood among them and said to them, peace be with you. They were confused at this point. They were scared. They're getting this good report that these two guys that we know and trust say Jesus is alive. But again, we haven't seen him yet, so we're not quite sure what to believe. The women said he was alive. Peter's come back. He's all pumped up and excited. But they're in this house, and it's locked down. They don't want anybody they don't know coming in. And they're not sure what their status in the community is, because they were all Jesus followers. And so they're in this lockdown room, and you know, maybe there's a couple dozen of them, and so they know who's in the room. And then all of a sudden, Jesus appears and is there in the room. And it's, you know, many of us have had that desire to be able to do that, I wish I could just be there now because I'm running about, you know, 6 minutes late. And if I could just be there, I could teleport or something like that. And we've never been able to do that, but Jesus just did it. He just appeared right there among them. And then he says, peace be with you. And what, peace be with you, it really has this kind of robust meaning. There's all of this theology behind that word, and it, you know, what shalom is and a wholeness, and all this is peace be with you. There's all of that, but then there's also just kind of this, it's also just kind of funny. Like if you just could have the power to appear in a room somewhere, most of us, not all of us, some of us are more creative than this, but most of us would just say, boo. And the people would freak out and kind of shriek. And that's kind of what Jesus does. He just shows up and he's like, peace be with you. And they just freak. They're like, what's going on? What's happening? We see in the next verse, it says they were startled and frightened, thinking they saw a ghost. Because he wasn't there and then he was there. And that's what ghosts do. And so we think this is a ghost. And then he says to him, why are you troubled? And why do doubts rise in your minds? Why are you troubled and why do doubts rise in your mind? Well, partially with trouble because people just appear right here. Like, you, Jesus, you just appeared. This is troubling to us. Then he goes, you're troubled. There's more than just being surprised and scared in that moment. They're troubled because all of life is unsettled at this point. The guy that they've shaped their lives around, that they've given up everything and followed for the last 3 years, has just gotten himself executed, embarrassingly so. And now they're starting to hear stories about him not being dead and being alive, and that would change everything. And so they're troubled because they're in the midst of this unknown. But then he says, why do doubts rise in your minds? Why are you doubting? What's going on? You're doubting. He knows where they are. He knows what they're experiencing, what they're feeling, and what they're thinking. And he just asks them a point-blank question. Why are you troubled, and why do doubts rise in your minds? And then he says this. Look at my hands and my feet. It is I, myself. Touch me and see. A ghost does not have flesh and bones, as you see I have. Jesus identifies what their doubts are surrounding, whether he's really alive or dead, whether it's him or whether it's an imposter, whether it's a ghost or some different form of him, or it's really him, if he's really alive. And he says, come and check it out. See for yourself. When he had said this, he showed them his hands and his feet, and while they were still, and why they still did not believe it, because of joy and amazement. Just hang right there for a minute. While they did not believe it because of joy and amazement is a fascinating sentence. I mean, because if we were to put ourselves right there, we're like, I'm in, I'm done. I didn't need to be like some of the other guys and actually put my hand in the hole in his wrist. Seeing it and maybe just touching his arm was enough for me. And so I'm in. I'm sold. I believe. But it says they still do not believe it. And the reason, it actually gives a reason why they didn't believe, because of joy and amazement. They were so caught up in the good news and the excitement and the emotion of the Jesus being here. They didn't bother to get all their questions answered and deal with all of the nuts and bolts of belief, the questions that they had. So they didn't believe everything. They didn't understand everything yet, because they were with Jesus, which is just fascinating to think about that. And many of us find ourselves in that very place. Whether it's that we don't have all our beliefs lined up, or we're still questioning some things, or whether it's doubts because of troubles that we've had, or it's doubts because of questions that we've got in our mind, or whether it's doubts because of our experiences in life, or whether it's doubts because of experience of others in our life, that we can relate to what it's like being in this place, not specifically closed behind a door hiding from our community because Jesus was executed and put in the grave, but we have those experiences, we have those questions, we have those doubts. And Jesus steps in this, and he seeks to address them and meet them where they're at. It goes on, and he says, Jesus asked them, do you have anything to eat here? And what that means when a guy rises from the dead and comes and he says, do you have anything to eat here? What that means is that he's hungry. And then they gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it in their presence. And what broiled fish represents in this setting at this moment is a viable meal, and that's it. So Jesus basically is like, "Hey, I'm hungry. Let's eat," and that's what that means. So it also means that, "Hey, I'm not a ghost, and watch, the food's going to go in me, and it's not going to be like a cartoon and fall down on the floor and be like, oh, there's a burrito." And I mean, it's not like. But beyond that, that's kind of it. Like, he's just like, I'm alive. I'm back. I'm back. I'm here with you. And we're going to sit around a meal and eat. And you're going to see and experience me. And I'm real. But He knows that they don't fully yet believe or understand. He knows that they still have doubts, and he showed up and he's with them. We've called this series that I believe that we need to step into in this next season. And to be perfectly honest, we don't know exactly how many weeks it's going to go yet. And we don't know all the topics that we want to address, but we've got a list going. But to spend some time exploring the questions and the doubts and the uncertainties that so many of us have. And some of us have them right on the surface, and we talk with our friends about them, and they're out there, and they're saying, "Hey, we're trying to deal with these things. These are some questions that I have as I'm either following Jesus or if I'm considering following Jesus." Others of us, we hold them back behind, and we don't let them be seen, and we kind of have this, for whatever reason, this sense of I've got to put on a good presentation that I'm in and that I'm believing that I'm on solid ground here when I'm really not. It's this thing feels shaky to me, and I feel like I could be in or out at any moment, and I've got a lot of questions. And in the same way that Jesus just shows up and says, "Hey, what are your doubts? What do you not believe? Like, let's talk about this." We want to be that kind of church where we're saying, "Let's put those out on the table. Let's create an environment where it's safe to question and to deal with those things." And so that's what we want to do over the next season here. And I just want to share with you four kind of maybe framing thoughts or maybe guidelines or ground rules as we step into this, or key kind of assumptions that we understand. And we don't have to agree on all these, but just that you understand that this is how we're coming into this conversation. So let me share these four with you. The first one is this. This might be readily obvious to you, or you might have no idea what I'm talking about with this one, but we're in a new age. We're in a new context where something has shifted. And when I say that, what I mean is the world in which we live, the culture that defines it, the ideas and the thinking and the living that we kind of live and breathe in every day has shifted considerably over the last several decades. Here's a good way to think about it. If you were to step back a generation, or certainly two generations, in our country, in our land, maybe let's say North America, but for sure our country, many people, a strong majority of people, would either identify as being a follower of Jesus by, they would say, "I'm a Christian," or they would say, I'm certainly pretending to be a Christian." One of those two things, and that was just a majority of people, that, hey, everybody kind of goes to church, everybody thinks that they're nominally a Jesus person, and we're not in that land anymore. And again, that's probably readily obvious to many of us. There are certainly, if you look on a map and if you look in our nation, there are certainly places in our country where that is still true, but that's becoming increasingly the minority and not the majority. That's not the way we think as a country. That's not the way that we approach life. That's not the under kind of girding assumptions about reality any longer. We've shifted, we've changed. And the way that culture shifts is that it's usually driven by what's going on the coasts. And we see that in voting patterns and those kinds of things. But culture shifts in our country on the coasts first and in the major city centers. And many of those are on the coast. And so we're in one of those, if you didn't know that. We're in one of the Portland, Vancouver metro areas, one of the top 25 largest in the city. Largest cities in the nation. And then culturally speaking, we are far, far higher than 25th in terms of influence in our country and in our culture. It's part of that is just because we're just so stinking cool. And so we just influence culture more. When you get your own TV show, you move up significantly. It's just how it goes. And when you actually think about the influence that we have, we're not just designing it, we're also reflecting it, right? But Portland, and for very good reasons, if you track back our history as a city, has been on the cutting edge in so many ways. And I don't mean like designing stuff, but that certainly can be part of it. But in the ways of thinking, of being out there, further out to the edge. And so we're definitely on the coast, not, you know, exactly, but we're on the West Coast, and we're a large city with a cultural influence. And so these changes affect us more dramatically. We feel them and live in them. And again, many of us have lived here. I've been here now almost 11 years. Some of you have lived here far longer. Some of you have realized how cool we are, and you've moved here more recently. And so, you know, we've all got a different story. We come here, but we know that it's different in this city than it is in many places, and And that's some of the reason why. And if we can describe what this shift has been as moving away from, one word to describe it is, understanding of the Christian nation, or another fancy way to say it is Christendom. That we've been we've been in the past in this mindset where many people assume or believe things that are consistent with the Christian faith. And that has shifted and changed. And what it's shifted from is to what we would call a post-Christian. It's after that. It's post. And it's characterized by moving away from those beliefs. And so the belief that Jesus is alive, the very thing that we gathered and celebrated last week, the thing that we've sung about already today and declared today and shapes our lives is a minimizing belief. It's reduced in the number of people that believe that. That the idea that Jesus was fully God and fully human, lived some 33 years on this planet, was executed and didn't stay dead but rose again, that idea has moved into kind of the fairy tale category. That fewer and fewer people believe that. That's what it means to be post-Christian. That this is considered just a book. And it's great for literature and it's great to study in college and that kind of thing. But it's the idea that it would be communicated from a divine being who knows and sees all and created all and gave us some written words that tell and reflect both his character and his story accurately and is worth us talking about and gathering about and looking closely at and reflecting on and reading and studying and shaping our very lives around, that it contains truth for our lives, that's a weird idea in the culture today, post-Christian. That's one of the things that we've experienced as a shift. Another way to describe it is by the word secular. And the word secular can mean a whole lot of different things. It's an elastic term and can mean a lot of other things. If I could just pick one part of what that means for us this morning, one of the things it means to be a secular culture in our, as we experience it today here in Portland, in the U.S., in North America, and in Western civilization, Western Europe, for example, is to be secular means that what is worth basing our lives on, what is true, is what can be proved as fact. And so science rises in its value and its place in our culture's priorities. It's esteemed higher because with science we can prove things as true. And what happens is what is true becomes limited by what science can prove. And anything outside of that becomes, again, kind of into myth or storytelling or fairy tales and that kind of thing, but in the areas of faith and belief, but not fact. And so in a secular culture, what can be proved as fact becomes most important. And anything outside of that is minimized or reduced. That's some of the shift that's gone on. And we feel it and we know it and we can identify it. And it can feel very unsettling. Again, some of us, you get kind of grown up in it and it feels normal. But then you choose to follow Jesus and you feel like, well, I'm on the outside now. I don't think like everybody else. I have to edit what I say and be careful about how I engage because I'm in a strong minority. And here's one of the reasons it's important that we acknowledge that as we step into this series together is that some of our, once we realize what's going on, and maybe that's put words to it for the first time, or maybe I've just echoed something that you've known or intuited for a long time, or maybe you've studied it and are really familiar with it, but once we put words to this is what's going on, as we've shifted in our culture and things have become very, very different, is that some of us have an instinct, and maybe it's even hard to identify, or maybe we've actually made plans on it. We have an instinct to pull back. I don't know how old this movie is. It's like 15 or 20 years old maybe, and it's not worth watching today. But some time ago, Jodie Foster starred in a movie called Panic Room. Appropriately not clapping for that. I just want to acknowledge that. Good work. I watched this movie however many years ago it was, and at the very beginning, I was really into Panic Rooms. So I was like, this is a great idea. Since we're so, uber wealthy, we should probably have a Panic Room in our home. And then by the end of the movie, I was like, panic rooms are dumb, and I can't afford one. But if you don't know what a panic room is, it's what wealthy people or pretend wealthy people put in their home. And it's the idea if you're ever like attacked or something's happening, you run into there and close the door, and then everything is good and safe and fine. And then if you care more about how you make a whole movie about that, then go ahead and watch it. But in the movie, they had screens of the security cameras of what's going on outside, and they had probably some supplies and food in there, but the power got cut, and so they had to actually open the door to go out and get... just fascinating drama. But the idea of a panic room is if we come inside and close the door, then we're safe. And as a follower of Jesus, that is a kind of an undergirding, always brewing temptation to to pull back and to find a safety net and to close the door and to be in a panic room kind of a situation where we can be safe and just hang on until Jesus returns and then all will be good. And but what happens there is that the power gets cut and then you're kind of screwed, or you run out of food, or you don't like who you're in there with, or all sorts of things go bad. But worse than that, if you and I do that as followers of Jesus, if we look around us and go, well, the landscape's changing, the culture's shifting, this is difficult to be a follower of Jesus, I'm gonna start conducting myself differently, or I'm gonna push back away and hide. What happens when we choose to do that is we begin living a different story that's not recorded here. And the God of the universe, as we read his story here and how he's worked with women and men over the course of human history, as we read about how God works, is that's not how he works. He works by walking with people into uncharted territory, into uncomfortable and unsafe scenarios. You go, I don't know what's actually going to happen. I can't plan out everything. I'm uncertain about so many things. But to step out into that, that's where God works. The whole idea of being a people of light and bringing a message of hope and truth into a dark place is stepping outside of whatever kind of panic room safety net we might want to create and going into a place that is uncomfortable, is in uncharted. It's unknown. But that's where God shows up. And not just for the people that might be out there already, but for those of us that would risk and take a step of faith and step out there. That's where we get stretched and we get changed. And he meets us in the places where we're ready to grow and become more of who we're designed to be. That we have to identify, this is one of the reasons that we want to step up. We want to pull our kids back in. We want to lock the door. We want to keep our friends, the ones that we like, that we're comfortable around, and be really safe and secure and shut the door to the panic room and be there. And that's just simply not how God works. And that's not how he wants to work. That's not how he's going to reach our city and our world, is by us pulling back. But there is a major shift going on. One of the things, and this is the second thing, if the first one is we're in a major shift, the second thing is this. Everyone lives by faith. Every single person that you've ever known, every single person sitting here today, whether you're a follower of Jesus or not, every single human being lives by faith. Part of what our culture tells us is to live by faith is foolish. And not all of our culture tells us that, but there is a strong, heavy message of that. Is to live by faith is foolish because we have this science that can prove us all these facts. And yet what we know is that there's a limit to that. Realize it's Sunday morning, but if I can read a short little quote by an American philosopher named C. Stephen Evans. He says this in regards specifically to science. Science, by its very nature, is not fit to investigate whether there is more to reality than the natural world. Science, by its very nature, is not fit to investigate whether there is more to reality than the natural world. We all know that. We learned that early on in class. And yet somehow that got pushed to the side, and all of the discussions, all the fascinating things of all the good that science can do and bring to us and point us to God for sure. It's not designed to. It doesn't have the capacity to. It cannot prove without a shadow of a doubt in terms of facts what's beyond the natural world. It's not engineered to do that. It's not designed to do that. It's not that capacity. It is limited in that. Interesting that it takes a philosopher to say that so succinctly, and when scientists should be saying that and clarifying that at the beginning of each class. But it can't tell us what's beyond the natural world, but there's so much in the natural world that points to Jesus. It's wonderful, but it's not designed to do that. There's so much beyond that. So much there. And that's where a lot of life is lived. That we live and we interact with one another and we reason and we relate and we function in the world beyond just what is factually proven. That's where a lot of life is lived. And so we all live by faith. And the reason that's important as we step into this series is because there's more than a few of us that feel as followers of Jesus that we're a few steps behind, that we're not as bright, that we're not as intelligent, that we don't have as many facts, or we end the conversation and then there's things that we don't know. And like the disciples, it might be because we don't yet believe, because we have joy and amazement, and that's a good thing. And but there's questions that we don't have answers to yet, and we haven't gotten there. We don't know that yet. We're not done in that way. And so we feel like we're at this deficit because we're a people of faith. And so we need to understand, and it's helpful to understand, and hopefully it's emboldening in a good and healthy and generous and kind way, that no, everyone lives by faith. You've chosen yours, you've chosen yours, you've chosen yours, I've chosen mine, we've chosen ours over here. Everybody lives by faith in some way or another. And so we don't need to feel less than, or we don't need to feel scared of, or we don't need to feel like we're behind in the game because somebody else declares, I have this proven, or I've read this, or I know this, or this is fact. We all live by faith. We just choose. Tim Keller, who's pastored in more than 30 years in New York City, another city on the coast that's post-Christian secular, he says this, to move from religion to secularism is not so much a loss of faith as a shift into a new set of beliefs. It's not a loss of faith, but it's a shift into a new set of beliefs and into a new community of faith. So think about that. All of, whether you're in this room or it's our friends outside of this room that would say, I don't have faith and I don't have a religion and I believe in secularism or humanism or pick an ism. They're a part of a community of faith as well. It's just a different kind. One that draws the lines between orthodoxy and heresy in different places. Western secularity is not the absence of faith, but a new set of beliefs about the universe. Number three, I want to look to a guy who I just find a lot of encouragement in his interaction with Jesus. This guy named Thomas. And Jesus shows up and says, peace be with you, and to the disciples. And then he does it again a week later when Thomas is there. And Thomas was not there for the first one, but he split. He kind of was a busy guy and getting to things. He picked up some new shifts at work because the guy he was following got himself killed. And so he was off with his schedule again and wasn't there the first time when Jesus appeared. And so here's what happens later. Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, which clearly why he would go by Thomas, one of the 12 was not with the other disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, we have seen the Lord. They tell Thomas that, we've seen the Lord. But Thomas said to them, unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. There's more than a few of us probably who have been at that place, or maybe we're at that place right now. I'm not believing and following Jesus unless he shows up and scares me and says, peace be with you, and let me check out his side. That's a common experience. A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them this time. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. And then he says this, stop doubting and believe. Stop doubting and believe. Which, again, that's different circumstance than us this morning, right? He's got his fingers about ready to go into Jesus' side, and Jesus is speaking to him audibly. Stop doubting and believe. Great. That's a little easier to make that leap of faith, that jump, that next step. Number three, Jesus is not passive. As we step in and ask the question where Jesus goes, this is one of the answers to that. Where Jesus goes is he goes to those of us who are questioning and doubting and uncertain. We have this idea, and it's a faulty one. We have this idea that when we have questions, whether they're out there in the open or whether we're holding them back because we don't feel safe to share them, when we have doubts, we have this idea, faulty idea, that Jesus is off on the sideline, hanging back, waiting for us to figure out our way, to read the right thing, to have the right conversation with the right person who knows the right answer, to have the right experience that shifts it all for us. And then we come back and reconnect with Jesus. Jesus is not passive off on the sideline. Jesus is pursuing us and walking with us and walking ahead of us, inviting us to go with him. Jesus is active. He goes after Thomas. He waits till he's in the home again. He goes, oh, I gotcha. And he shows up. Watch this trick again. Boop, I'm here. Thomas, check me out. I'm here. I came and found you. Let's talk. Jesus pursues us. He's not passive. Every question that we have, every doubt that we have, every struggle, whether it be existential on a deeply personal level, whether it be emotional on a relational level, whether it be intellectual, whatever it is, when we say where Jesus goes, what we mean by that is that Jesus is already there. We have to figure out how to engage with him and question him and process with him, but he's already there. We're not going to find a topic or a question or a struggle that he's not already fully aware of. We've got all the intellectual questions that have been there for generations, but we've got new ones because the landscape has shifted. The culture has shifted. And so we're asking new questions and different things. We've started an initial list of some of them. Pain and suffering, that's not a new one, but that was one for me in my mid-20s that I just felt like I ran into a brick wall in processing through that. Pain and suffering is one. Obviously, science, we've already mentioned that. Maybe the whole idea of evolutionary psychology and how we're thinking about the human mind and engaging that and how we relate to one another. Injustice, there's so many areas of injustice, and not just the kind of injustice, but the significance of it and the awareness of it. And why, Jesus, do you have an answer for that? What's your answer for that? Because if I don't understand your answer and you're not connected to that, how does all this work? Why, another one is, why are there so many people that are such poor representations of Jesus? Like, if Jesus was going to pick his representatives, why are them so bad? Like, if somebody was representing me and they just failed so poorly, I'd be like, yeah, let's break up. Like, why doesn't Jesus just kind of tweet an answer like, oh, those peeps aren't with me? And they're like, but he's identified with all these people that are so far from who he is. Why does that happen? That just complicates it, makes it harder for all the rest of us that are trying to follow him. Jesus isn't passive. Last one is this. What happens next for Thomas as he says this? Thomas said to him, this is his reply, my Lord and my God. My Lord, it's a declaration of faith. Thomas is a changed person in that moment. He sees Jesus, sees the holes in his wrists and his hands and in his side, and he gets some of his questions answered, and he makes this declaration of my Lord and my God. It's the very beginning verses, words of the book of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and at the end we've got Thomas saying, this is God, God in the flesh. What questioning and doubt did for Thomas was move him forward in his faith. And so the fourth thing is this, is our questions and our doubts and our uncertainties, they might feel dangerous. They might feel like we're wobbling and we're going to fall out of the game. Or they might be so pressing and huge that we don't even feel like we can make a step of following Jesus. And yet it's these places in our lives and in our thinking and in our processing that Jesus is going to meet us and he's going to grow us and deepen our faith in him and our relationship with him. And so we don't need to be fearful of them. We need to be honest and sober about them, but we don't need to be fearful of them. Jesus wants to meet us there and move us forward. We want to, as we continue on in this series, over and over come back to the Father's prayer. When Jesus speaks to this father, this young boy that needed to be healed, and he said, I believe, help my unbelief. We point back to that so regularly and want to be consistent in that now, that we believe, but we need help. For many of us, it's we believe and we have some unbelief that we want help with. And as we do that, how we think about God and God meeting us in this is really important. I want to read one last quote and then we're going to sing and come to the table together. But if you would close your eyes and just listen to these words. And I wish I could give credit to the author, but I took a picture with my phone of this book when I was reading it and I don't have the title in it. And so these are not my words, but some brilliant person wrote them in a book. Listen to these words. It takes us back to Peter's amazement as he walks out of the tomb. It says this, the real God startles us, draws close to us, and amazes us. The real God sweeps into our humdrum lives and sweeps us up into his plan to restore all things to their intended order. The real God pushes us so far out of our comfort zones that we tremble, and then promises never to leave us or forsake us. He asks us to surrender our lives and then exchanges them for the eternal kind.